So, Dave, when I first got this job, I was sent to Washington, D.C., and I was lucky enough to hang around with Michelle Norris from All Things Considered. And I spent some quality time on Robert Siegel's couch watching him work on a piece.
The big dogs.
And it was the closest thing to a how to be on NPR manual. Now, usually in a new job, you get a little on-site training, except for maybe the presidency of the United States. So imagine if you are, say, President Clinton II, President Obama, President McCain, and you walk into the Oval Office, and there, bam, on your desk, someone has left you a guide to being a great president. Well, that's the premise of a new book called What a President Should Know, But Most Learn Too Late, written by someone who served as a senior White House advisor and staff for three Republican presidents, including the current president, for whom he had this advice back in 2002. You know, that war, probably going to cost you about $100 to $200 billion. And at the time, the White House thought that number was far too high. Lawrence Lindsay is kind enough to join us this morning, which happens to be President's Day. Good morning, Mr. Lindsay.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So you have a quote from LBJ in the beginning of your book, and you said that the president's task is not to do what is right, but to know what is right. Why did you pick that quote?
Well, I think it is actually the challenge, because someone coming into the office has no idea what's going to hit them. It's not quite a surprise a minute, but it might be a surprise a week. And they have to be prepared for just about anything.
Now, this way your book is set up for our listeners, I want to describe it. It's a series of memos dated January 20th, 2009. It sort of breaks down various things a new president will encounter. And you make it clear early on the book that the statement, "Yes, Mr. President," can lead to your downfall.
Yes, what you have, I mean, let's face it, just look at what's happening to our candidates. They've spent 2 years on the campaign trail. They're facing cheering crowds all the time, you know, and no one around them is going to tell them a bad thing. Then they walk into the Oval Office, and everyone starts calling them Mr. President, even people who've known them their entire lives. Well, that's not exactly something that's going to make someone grounded. They're going to quickly forget who they are, where they came from, and they're going to be surrounded by people saying yes or other people who want something. And I think a president ought to go in knowing that, because, you know, if you're a rock star going in, it's only going to get worse. And what you need is to, you know, keep your bearings, remember where you came from, and know what you're there to do.
So do you need to find your closest advisor, someone who will actually pull you aside and say, no, sir, not the best idea, or no, ma'am?
Absolutely. It helps to have someone who's known you your entire life or most of your life who can do that, and it's a pretty tough thing to find.
So you think it's okay to bring somebody aboard who has been part of your inner circle for a long time?
Well, they're the most likely to be able to say no or no, Mr. President. Oftentimes a presidential spouse plays that role quietly, but it's nice to have someone, even as chief of staff, who's been around you, who you trust, and therefore feels comfortable telling you the truth.
Is that your most important pick as president, chief of staff?
Absolutely, because from the chief of staff comes everything else. They're the ones who pick the rest of the West Wing staff, and that person also should not be afraid to have different opinions around and people willing to be outspoken and say, no, that's not the right way to go.
There was a dizzying number in the book that there are some 1,500 slots to fill in every new administration. Now, when it comes to closest advisors, you suggest there are four types of people to have in your inner circle: persuaders, thinkers, a manager, and a loyalist. Can you give me a quick breakdown on each?
Sure. Persuaders, they're the people we see most of the time. They're the White House press spokesman. They're the people who go up on Capitol Hill. And to a large extent, it's the president himself or herself who's out there trying to persuade people. Thinkers. Well, you know, this is oftentimes the hardest thing to find, because they need people who can step back from the day-to-day world and say, you know, where are we going to be in 6 months? Where are we going to be in a year? Because it's always going to be tempting to do something now that gets you applause and gets you cheering crowds. The consequences come down the road, and you need a thinker to sort of hold the rest of them back. Managers. Well, you know, you mentioned the 1,500. There are another 1,500 who technically the president could appoint, but they tend to stay. They're mostly in the foreign policy area. That's 3,000 people, and then there are about 1.5 million federal civilian workers. That's a big management job. You know, it's the largest corporation on earth, And just keeping track of it all, you got to have somebody to do that. And finally, loyalists. This is the one that's most dangerous. There's two kinds of loyalists.
Yeah, because that could be used as a pejorative.
You're right. And if someone is a loyalist and is a loyalist because they say, yes, Mr. President, of course you're right, that kind of loyalist, you know, that's more like a sycophant, right? And that's what the president doesn't need. What they need is someone who is has been long-term loyal and is not afraid as a result to give the president the bad news.
We're having a conversation this morning with Lawrence Lindsay, author of What a President Should Know But Most Learn Too Late. All right, so let's say you've assembled the perfect staff. You write about, in terms of what issues to tackle on the subject of this memo dated January 20, 2009, unsolvable problems, pick one. You suggest that trying to go after healthcare, education, and energy, not the smartest move. Tell us why you should just pick one, and then after you pick it, what's your first step?
Well, you know, the three that you mentioned, you know, they're problems that are still with us. We've been talking about energy independence now, right, since the 1970s, and we haven't gotten there. Healthcare has been an issue, well, going back into the 30s, and education has been an issue going back into the 1830s. And the reason the country doesn't solve them is it has nothing to do with special interests. It has to do with the fact that there are competing objectives. Liberty and equality, for example, compete in each one of those. So if you're going to spend your time trying to solve one of these big problems, you're taking on something with a lot of historical roots, and you better spend all your political capital and all your political energy going on that one and not trying to spread yourself too thin trying to tackle everything.
You recommend that the next president take office planning to serve only one term so they can focus, quote, solely on the things that motivated you to run in the first place.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. A lot of the people that come in with the president and maybe the president himself tends to be focused a lot on winning re-election. That's, after all, what, you know, that's sort of the carrot that's out there for doing a good job. But in fact, if that's what you're focused on, you're going to tackle things that make you popular and not things that are real problems. And, you know, whether the president actually runs for re-election or not is another matter, but they should go in there thinking that they're not. So that way they're able to do the tough things and not simply court popularity.
The incoming president in 2009 is going to face the threat of a recession if we're not already in a recession. Now, based on your experience in the White House during the 2001 recession, what do you think the president's plan of action should be?
Well, you know, we don't often give President Bush the credit for doing things right, but one of the things he did do right was he came into office expecting something like that to happen and had a plan, and he implemented the plan. Now, you can quibble about the details, but, you know, he was ready for that one. And what I think the incoming president should do is come in there with a plan. You know, it's pretty likely that they're going to face some tough economic sledding. And they ought to have a detailed plan going in, because on January 20th, it's too late to make one up.
All right. Your book is also the first time you set the record straight on that 2002 estimate, which a lot of people associate with you, and you even admit will probably be in your obituary at some point.
Unfortunately.
Hoping that's for a very long time off, sir. had you known what's been going on, that we would end up in the trillions, what would your advice to the president have been?
Well, again, you know, I think that the bottom line on any conflict is whether or not, is a cost-benefit analysis. And almost always, if the nation achieves its objectives, the benefit exceeds the costs. And so what's going to matter in Iraq is if, for example, we're able to establish a stable, a somewhat democratic country there, we'll have, you know, incalculable benefits for peace in the Middle East, security in the region, oil, what have you, a whole list of things. If, on the other hand, we end up, you know, getting kicked out, you know, maybe because we are defeated or fear we're going to be defeated, we're going to have tremendous costs. We're going to look weak. Other bullies in the region are going to be empowered, particularly Iran. The flow of international oil is going to be insecure. Israel is going to be threatened, et cetera.
This is a TBD.
It's TBD. That's exactly right. And so the most important thing is not the cost of the war. It's whether or not you have a plan to win it. You know, if Pearl Harbor, FDR said, you know, World War II is just going to cost too much, You know, that's kind of a silly thing to say.
But doesn't the cost of the war affect everything else the president has on his plate?
It does. You know, the number you gave is a big number, but it's spread over many, many years.
Well,
the actual cost of Iraq is, you know, it's about 1.5 times what we spend on cosmetics and hair care every year. So if you think of it that way, it's certainly an affordable number.
Well,
that doesn't mean it's a prudent thing to do. That's another issue. And it's only a prudent thing to do if you got a winning strategy.
Mr. Lindsay, Dave Folkenflik here.
Hey, Dave, sorry.
No, not at all. I just wanted to ask if you could take us back into the Bush White House in that first administration. You talk in the book about the need for people to tell truth to even the president as well as his senior circle. You sort of conveyed information, which at least press reports indicated was not well received when you talked about what you thought was the real cost. And if I'm not mistaken, you were sort of issued a speedy one-way ticket to other environs. Tell us what it's like to be a senior advisor in the White House and to convey news that is not welcome. What is the reaction like?
Well, you know, the president handled it well. The communicators in particular did not, because it wasn't sticking to the message of the day. And one thing we should watch for presidents when they're running is watch how much message discipline they have. If it's all communication and not too much substance, then we're probably going to be in for trouble after they get elected.
You know, Senator Clinton is somebody who has presented herself as not only a person of substance, which I think most people and observers and those who know or cover her would say, but also a person of experience, somebody who can get things done. How much does her time as the first spouse influence her ability to have a better grasp, perhaps, of the lessons that you're trying to offer from day one, as she would say?
Well, you know, I think it certainly helps. I think she probably has a picture, more of a picture of what she's going in for than the other candidates. The other advantage she offers is, the much-vaunted Clinton machine. You know, there is a sort of almost a semi-permanent staff around the Clintons that's been there now for 16 years, and they could be plugged in fairly quickly and fairly seamlessly. So I think that is probably what the real advantage Mrs. Clinton has when she says she's ready to govern from day one.
Before we let you go, we've got about 30 seconds left. Is there one thing that you've noticed in your research of this, in your personal experience, that new presidents consistently get wrong?
Oh, yeah. What they get wrong is how much they're going to be affected by the job. You know, and that's why I think it's so important that we not put in someone who's just been a rock star the entire campaign, that we put in someone who, you know, has had some defeats in their life and knows how to handle them, someone who has a broad range of experience in their background so that they can call on different historical events and how it affected them. They also, need to be well enough grounded that they can tell the difference between an enemy of the United States and a political opponent.
Hard to discern where our guest is coming from.
Lawrence Lindsay, author of new book, What Presidents Should Know But Most Learn Too Late. Thank you, Mr. Lindsay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
He was for Mr. Thompson. Didn't work out.
Well,
should say that for the record,
so much,
by the way. Hey, David Folkenflik, thank you so much for joining us on the BPP.
Kind of you to have me here. It's fun.
I'm Allison Stewart. Happy birthday to Rachel Martin. And a little bit of Matt Martinez filling in. What's that, Matt? Do we have that? No? And